Today on the show, we'll talk to Alex Glow. She is the lead hardware nerd at Hackster.io.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
This is Triangulation, episode 379, recorded Monday, December 17th, 2018, for Friday, January 4th, 2019. Alex Glow. Welcome to Triangulation. This is the show where every week we talk to some of the most interesting people working in technology, working with technology. And today I'm super excited to talk to Alex Glow. She is a maker, a creator, an excellent explainer for Hackster.io in San Francisco. Now, I first learned about Alex's work when I read about Archimedes, aka Archie. That's her robot familiar. If you're watching the video version and not just listening, which you should, you can see Archimedes right now. And Archimedes can judge your emotions using Google AIY, which we'll talk all about that. Thank you so much for joining us, Alex.
Thank you for inviting me. I'm super stoked.
I like to start from the beginning. When did you know that you loved hardware? When did you first realize you loved hardware?
Oh, boy. So FIRST Robotics is an amazing program, and I happened to go to an all-girls school, and we had a team, Team 677, yeah! And I loved working with, oh, you have pictures, cool. Sorry. I was really having a lot of fun on the controls team, so we were doing some programming in QBasic, I think. Might have been PBasic. And I got to do things like stripping wires and soldering stuff together, and I got to be a driver, which obviously is the most fun job on the team. And that, working with giant robots, you never get over it, right? I mean, they're not like giant, but they're like kind of giant.
So what were some of your earliest projects, your earliest stuff that you made?
So I made this musical cyborg juggling machine, which was this harness thing that strapped to my waist with a cigar box on it that had a bunch of motors. And so I had made these sort of gloves out of leather with little copper wires running up, and then made these little copper rings that some others connected to on my fingers. And I would juggle these tinfoil balls, and they would basically act as really crude switches. So the ball would connect the two contacts, and that would allow power to flow to one of the motors. And those had, there were little DC motors that had zip ties attached to them, so when they spun, the zip ties would hit these bolts that were attached to magnets on the box, and they would make this horrible vibratey buzzy noise. And also there was a spark gap on there. Yeah. So it made this like kind of shocking blue thing that you didn't want to touch. So it was like a noise machine. It was supposed to play like a thumb piano, but I didn't have the skills to like make one at that time. So that was pretty awful. And then I made something more intense when I read about the Make's $5 Cracker Box amp project and decided to build that. And that was my first like sort of legit electronics project. But I was also making a lot of non-electronic stuff at the time, and that sort of continues. So I love like the tactile part of making him. Like, so there's a lot of 3D printing in here, but there's also, I tend to find that when you're doing 3D modeling and stuff, you get kind of divorced from the tactile sense of it. And that's actually why he ended up so cute, because I didn't have the frame of reference to see that his head was so much bigger than his body. And that's a huge thing in robotics. Like, if you want a critter to be cute, you I think it has to do with, like, neoteny, like how we find young things cute. And children have, like, larger heads proportionally to their bodies. And so when you want to make something look cute, if you give it, like, big eyes, sort of, like, wide apart, and, like, give it a big head in proportion to its body, then it ends up a lot sort of cuter. But also there's a lot of sort of physical stuff, like molding the wires, and like now I'm changing his wings so that you have to attach them with elastic because it kept breaking. I was doing that this morning, actually.
I love his little hat. Is there something under the hat? Does the hat have a purpose, or just to be jaunty?
Yeah. So it is jaunty, but it's there because he's got this arcade button as part of the AIY kit, and I'm not sure why it's not turning on. He's finicky. But the arcade button although it has this little sort of visible part, has an actual stem that's about this big with a screw on it where you have a nut that sort of attaches it to stuff. And so I didn't have space to put that in the head as well as the Raspberry Pi and everything that's inside there. So I decided to just give him a little hat, and it's basically exactly the size that it needs to hold the arcade button.
Awesome. And does he make noise?
He does. When his brain fires up, you know, it's always something, you know. He's a bit of a diva. So I'm going to replug his brain in. This is just a battery pack. And we'll see in about 4 minutes if he wakes up. Come on, dude. We can do this.
What? So he has you use Google AIY.
Yeah.
Tell us what that is.
So AIY is sort of a contraction of DIY and AI. So it's there's these kits that are designed to teach people to build their own artificial intelligence projects. And they're really good, actually. There's one called the Vision Kit, which is pretty self-explanatory, and the one called the Voice Kit, which is sort of for building your own voice assistant. And so you see it comes in this little cardboard box. It has a piezo buzzer for sound and a little camera and stuff. And you can make your own Python scripts to program it. It runs on a Raspberry Pi Zero W board. So what I like about the Vision Kit is that it doesn't actually require the internet in order to run. Even though it has a Pi Zero W, which is the like wireless Wi-Fi and Bluetooth version, you don't actually need those in order to make the kit run. It will run like offline super easily, which is great if you're going to like Maker Faire or something, which I'm sure you've probably been. But if you ever tried to connect to like the internet or even cellular, it's kind of a nightmare. And so, hey, there we go. Now, let's wake your motors up. There we go. Okay. Why don't you try and see what emotions people are doing? Anyway, so you can hear him make little beep boops sometimes, and his like little hat will light up depending on what emotion he thinks you're doing. He's being a little bit of a diva as usual. But so the AOI kit's super great, and he's based on the Vision Kit. His current programming makes him think that people are sad most of the time. So when you see him go blue, that's what that means, as well as the bit-a-boop. That means sadness. But I think that I can modify that pretty easily in order to make it so that he... it's very distracting. In order to make it so that he is a little bit more optimistic about the world, you know?
That's good. We should all, once you figure out how to make him do that, figure out how the rest of us can do that too.
Actually, kind of working on that. Like, that's what this thing is a little bit. I have this whole series of projects that I call mind-altering gadgets because I'm really interested in how to like modify your psyche in positive ways without using either chemicals or implants or whatever, because I'm definitely too squeamish for that. But you know, so this idea is that, you know, what if you could make a sad lamp on your face? And it turns out that there's a few companies developing this right now. So I sort of ganked their research. And it turns out that if you use a blue LED that's really close to your eyes, it's similar to using, you know, full spectrum or whatever bulbs from that far away where it has to be 10,000 lux and take a bunch of power. You put it up here, this can run on 5 volts. And you just put it on your face. It looks really... dorky and cyborgy right now, but I kind of love that. But probably for like later versions, it'll look a little bit more normy.
So in this picture, are you wearing glasses or is that just the blue light that we're seeing?
The blue light, yeah. Oh.
So you said sad lamp, like a seasonal affective disorder lamp.
Yeah, and this can also be used to adjust your circadian rhythms so that you get over jet lag, for example, faster. It's a super cool concept. And so there's 3 companies right now that are building face-mounted versions of this, which I think is a great development. It's much more portable, you know, and you can sort of wear it as you go about your business for the first, like, 20 or 30 minutes of your day. There's not a total amount of agreement on how long you should wear it for or how many lumens or what exact wavelength you should use, but they have a fair amount of agreement between, like, you know, in a certain range. Somewhere between like 20 or 30 minutes, like 450 nanometers, I think, is like the blue wavelength. Obviously, no UV. You don't want to be piping UV into your eyes, you know. That don't shine it directly in. That's bad. Make it like kind of diffused.
So talk about like a project like the Glow Up. How does that start? Do you like learn about the sad mirrors and think I can do that and put it on my face? Like talk us through the evolution of one of these projects.
Yeah, actually, so these two have kind of a similar backstory. So in this case, Google sent us their vision kit and their voice kit, and I built them on the show, and I decided that I wanted to make a project with it for Maker Faire, and just started brainstorming from that, like, what can we do that will make this more interesting? And from this, this was inspired by the badge life culture, so people getting really excited about building PCB circuit board badges for conferences. And I was like, well, most of these things end up in a drawer, right? And they don't serve a lot of use, which is cool. Art is great. But, you know, what if we could make it so that it will actually help you? And I was like, well, it's winter. Like, what can we do that's seasonal, that isn't just snowflakes and, you know, because California. And, you know, snowflakes and holly and whatever. So I was like, well, you know, seasonal affective disorder is obviously extremely seasonal. It's got seasonal in the name. And it's something that could be very affecting to people who are inside a lot as well, people who go to conferences are often traveling from somewhere far away. So this could be useful for both of them. And I started out thinking, what if we made like a big grid of LEDs, like the Mr. Robot badge has like a 16 by 16 grid of LEDs or something. And I was looking at things for that, and it was like 10,000 lumens. And I was like, holy crap, that's going to take so much power. It's going to drain your batteries instantly. So like, what if you, you know, since light decays like in an inverse square over distance, right? What if you put it up closer to your face? And then I started doing some research and figured out that people are already doing this. And so I was like, yes, it's not really proven technology yet. It's not super accepted in culture. So all these companies that are producing these products have pages on their websites about like, how does it work? What is the science? Because they have to still prove themselves to their potential customers. So I was able to just sort of yoink that and use it for my own research, and happen to have some blue LEDs on hand. It also depends on like what I'm interested in investigating at that time. So I wanted to do more robotics, and I'm really interested in wearables that go beyond just LEDs. So that was part of Archimedes' inspiration as well. And in this case, I've been playing around with this Bantam Tools desktop PCB mill. And so I was able to use Adobe Capture I just drew out these shapes on a piece of paper, used the Adobe Capture app to turn those into really crisp, clean images and SVGs, dropped those into the Bantam mill software, and sort of resized them so that they became this, just from a drawing. And so this is a double-sided PCB substrate that was just milled out. And I had the LEDs on hand, and everything else is just kind of obviously sort of janked together. This is a little 5-volt USB connector that I had from another kit. And yeah, sort of stuck them all together.
How did you learn all this? Like, where does one go to learn how to use Adobe Capture and do? I mean, it was just evolving over the years. How did you learn all these skills?
A lot of it is evolving over the years. A lot of it is having diverse interests. So Adobe Capture I learned about from following people like cartoonists and animators and stuff. There's so many cool people doing stuff on the internet, in all kinds of different media, of course. So like, I kind of soak up everything. Like there's stuff that I pull from music technology and from other kinds of stuff. I don't know. and wearable tech and whatever. So you kind of, I think, Capture I learned about from some kind of a comics tutorial or something. But a lot of my skills I picked up from Hacker Spaces, and in particular, All Hands Active, which is aka the AHA shop, which is sort of Ann Arbor's hackerspace. Oh, yeah! And NoiseBridge as well. So NoiseBridge is sort of the best known Bay Area hackerspace. And they happen to be running a fundraiser right now, if I may mention it.
Hey.
Sweet. I think it's donate.noisebridge.net. But because they're having some issues with the landlord deciding not to renew the lease, and so we need to find like a permanent home, and it would be awesome if people can sort of like push and just get a few extra donations in there. That's all the like salespersoning I'm going to do. But like, Hackerspaces are awesome, and that's where I learned like most of the stuff that I know about this stuff, besides independent exploration. And if you just, it's sort of serendipitous. You go and work on, you know, your bike lights or whatever. There happen to be people working on other cool stuff in the same space. You ask them what they're doing. They ask you what you're doing. Stuff happens, and just organically, you learn so much cool stuff that solves problems you didn't even know that you had. It's so cool. It helps sort of maintain your momentum.
So for people who are listening who might not know what a hackerspace is, how would you best describe one?
Oh, it's like a community workshop. So they might be familiar with things like Tech Shop, which is sort of a commercial hackerspace, sort of for profit. And that will have typically like staff and people who like are employed to fix the machines. A hackerspace is sort of the community version of that that was sort of around first. And that sort of arose from people having some tools but and wanting to share them with other people and wanting to sort of pool their resources to get, for example, a laser cutter, a drill press, you know, a 3D printer, things like that. And so you can go there and there's like industrial sewing machines. There's vinyl cutters for making cool stickers. And I'm going to unplug his brain now because... Yeah, there's stuff for everyone. There's like programming classes that are often free or donation-based and stuff like that. So it's sort of a self-sustaining space. Often the space itself is a sort of project that the community is doing. There's this philosophy of duocracy, which is that if you think something should happen or should be changed, then you do it. It's not like you write on the list being like, hey, someone should do this thing. And then everyone is basically just going to be like, you just volunteered. Sweet. Do it. So it's very much this sort of like DIY ethos, but also do it together.
So how would you, what's the difference between a hackerspace and a makerspace?
Oh, yeah. So I think the terms are basically interchangeable. And in England, for example, you'll hear hackspace instead of hackerspace. Mm-hmm. And they're all pretty much the same thing. Like, I think hackerspace maybe was a term that was around before makerspace, and then people started saying makerspace because it's a little more inclusive. It doesn't imply that you have to be doing stuff with technology. Like there's stuff for, you know, fabric arts and other types of visual art as well. And like food hacking, which is like, you know, there was someone at Noisebridge for a while who was making these healthful vinegars or something. So there's lots of people who are into like fermentation, and that's not, you know, strictly technology based, but it is something that sort of people in the same kind of community can get behind. And so I think that's where the makerspace word comes from. But I think that hackerspace was more the original term coming from like CBase in Berlin and stuff.
So occasionally I'll volunteer in the elementary school's makerspace. And cool. It's really just a closet with like yarn and paint and, you know, and some of the moms of boys came in to complain like, well, this isn't really a makerspace. There's no stuff for boys. I imagine through your,
I know.
And I said, yes, there is. And I imagine through your experience, you've probably many times been the only woman in the room or really, you know, a lot of your stuff is what might be called crafty. And so talk a little bit about how that's been just sort of, you know, moving through the world as as a woman who's really interested in hardware and art.
Totally. So first up, I will say that I've had a relatively easy time of it because I have a lot of privilege based on my own presentation. Like I am white, I'm skinny, like I'm fully abled and stuff. So I have a lot easier time of it than some other people for sure. But yeah, so now that I have some visibility through my job and stuff, I actually really love the fact that I get to sort of spread this word that you don't have to be. Those things aren't mutually exclusive. Like, I love seeing it when dudes do things that are super textile focused. Like, there's actually a lot of people that I know who identify as dudes who wear, like, nail polish and stuff and use that as a way of expression. Like, part of this badge life culture, actually, one of the main proponents of it, Drew Festini, was sort of inspired this whole fingernail hacking series of projects, although people were already doing that, like Sophie Wong and Naomi Wu, and so we're like already doing some of that stuff. But yeah, so that sort of became a thing, and I love how inclusive that was. I feel like it's definitely a part of my job to help break down those barriers for everyone so that people don't see, like, oh, yarn and glue, like, that's obviously not for boys. Like, what if your little son is, like, really excited about that? That would suck. And the same thing for, like, the girls, you know, you don't want to have anyone be feeling like they can't get into technology because of how they are. One of the most important things I think about promoting inclusion is giving people the opportunity early on to get some of the basics down so that they feel confident stepping into a space like a hackerspace. So for example, I feel like the stuff that I learned at in robotics in high school gave me a strong ground to, like, keep experimenting with, like, my university private server during college, for example, but also getting into the hackerspaces afterwards and sort of proving that I had a place there. It kind of sucks that in most communities you do have to kind of prove that you deserve to be there, that you have an interest. But that's definitely the case. And so I just saw that actually I was busy on that day, but I found out that Black Girls Code ran a robotics workshop for a ton of young women in Oakland on Saturday. And I would love to help support that because, like, that's the exact kind of thing that you need, which is, like, this early exposure so that people have the confidence to sort of, like, hold their own and feel like, yes, I can step into this space and not feel like I'm a representative of my gender, and by not being great at tech, I'm, like, influencing people's perception of women as a whole, you know? I think that's one of the most important things, is that if you are the only person who looks like you in a room, then you feel like you have to be perfect, you have to be so on point, because otherwise it's like, you know, that you're reinforcing stereotypes. So I feel like that's where a lot of the power lies, I guess, to change stuff.
And so have you seen a lot of the hackerspaces running, I mean, needing to raise more money? Like, you talked about Noisebridge, like, is there, are they on the decline? Or, I mean, it seems like the maker movement was really big, and now I'm not so sure. I mean, what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think that definitely that is something that hackerspaces always have to be mindful of. They often live in these spaces that may end up getting priced out as rents rise in their area and stuff, which affects everyone, you know, hackerspaces as well, but also other small local businesses and things. I think the maker movement is such a conundrum, right? Because there's been companies like that tried to sort of monetize it or market towards makers. Pardon me. And they seemed to sort of assume that everyone wanted to start at zero technology and become like a tech magnet or like create their own company or whatever. And not everyone wants to do that. Most of makers want to be hobbyists. Like, they have another job and this is like what they do on the side. Although a lot of people would love to do that. And also, I lost my train of thought there.
The maker movement.
Yeah, so a big part of that, right, is that you're able to kind of clutch things together from what you already have. It's this creative reuse thing as well as anything else. And so when you come in and start being like, here, makers, I have this $300 board that's perfect for your project, and people are like, but can I get it for free? Or like, can I make this some other way? Like, everyone, it's this really ingenious community of, like, you know, building with what you already have, building things for cheap and stuff. And so if people try to monetize that, then those efforts are probably not going to work super great. And I think that's part of where the, you know, for a while, tech companies were really trying to go at it one way, which was sort of, let's try and take this and really monetize it. And the way that they were doing it didn't really mesh with the community, so it wasn't very super successful in the end. But the hackerspaces, as communities, I think, continue to flourish. It's just that, you know, as with other communities, as rents rise and things get more crowded, then it becomes harder for people to find good spaces for it. And then, you know, so Tech Shop went bust, but some of those spaces have been taken over by other companies or, like, more local companies and sort of fractured. And I think a lot of those shards still live on and will keep growing.
So is that kind of the spirit with that Hackster was born? Just kind of not trying to necessarily sell $300 boards, but really create a hackerspace, more of a hackerspace online?
Oh, I love that. Yeah, exactly. And the whole time we haven't been trying to make money off of the makers. Like, that's not how our model works, which is, I think, why we've managed to be so successful. So it's always been this, we used to call it the Robin Hood model, where basically we have a lot of big companies that use us, like Microsoft, Samsung, Intel, etc. And they would, for example, pay for a white label version of a page. So WindowsOnDevices.com, for example, was this thing where Microsoft had their IoT Windows 10 core, and they made a site for it, and there was a project sort of area in that site that was just texture with a skin on it that sort of matched their whole site lookout, so it was seamless. So they paid us for that. And, you know, for big companies where they're able to pay for, you know, running big contests and giveaways and things, paying for interview series, for example, we have a really great collaboration with Arm right now with their innovator series. So I've gotten to interview some really cool people for that. And so that's kind of like what the site has supported itself on, rather than trying to market boards specifically directly to makers. And, you know, I think we saw some companies go about it in a way that wasn't going to work super great. But then there's other companies that are coming in and doing a really great job of it. So we're still kind of in the mix there.
Well, I've been getting the Hackster IO email for maybe 8 months. I get it every day. I probably won't ever build any of this stuff. I might, but like, I just enjoy it sort of like I like looking through Instagram and just like looking at the amazing things that people do. Do you think you have a lot of audience that just sort of lurks and doesn't create? Or do you think most of your audience is people that are really going to do it?
I think both, because there's, you know, I follow a lot of like cartoonists and stuff, and I'm probably not going to become a cartoonist or anything, but I love to see that. I love to see what people are building, and it feels really inspiring, even if I'm not going to do that direct thing. It inspires me in sort of what I'm going to be doing in a separate medium, and maybe that's sort of like what people get into. I can't look at our Twitter feed because I immediately end up with 80 tabs open, and it's a problem. But I think we do have like a ton of Facebook and Twitter followers, and a big part of what I try to do is make things that are accessible to people who don't want to spend a bajillion hours on webinars learning how to do specific things. Like, there's so much about that kind of aha moment, you know, if you're able to build something in a very short amount of time. And obviously that's if you were to build something, you know, ideally my job would be making it much easier for you to find something that inspires you to do that and to jump off and do it. But yeah, I think we do have a lot of people who just follow us on Instagram or whatever because they like looking at cool robots. That's fine too.
Yeah. I mean, it's aspirational. I think I'm not going to say I'm never going to do it. I never say never. So how can people get involved with Hackster? Like, how does it work for people if they are makers or they're just lurkers like me?
Yeah, well, you can just sign up for an account. And then if you sign up for an account, then that's pretty great because you get to like stuff and bookmark stuff and you can follow specific communities. So a lot of people are, you know, obviously Hackster is a super broad community that involves a lot of different things. And so maybe you have more specific interests like wearable tech or robotics or home automation, things that you can build that will make your office less awful. I don't know. Yours looks kind of great. And I love mine too. But, you know, that's not always the case. So, you know, whatever you're interested in, you can probably help narrow down that kind of fire hose that you see of lots of really cool stuff all the time and be like, okay, these are the things I'm interested in. Maybe like these are the specific boards that I have and I'll follow those communities. And you can really kind of drill down into what you want to find.
Getting back to the idea of hackerspaces, I've noticed that our local library has a 3D printer now that people can just borrow. I don't know if that's pretty. Is that a good place for people to start?
Definitely. I love libraries. Let me just say, like, the way that, like, librarians are such badasses, and the fact that they're so committed to bringing all these different resources to people for free or as inexpensively as possible is amazing. Like, I listen to audiobooks on my phone that I just use an app to get from the library. It's amazing. So libraries are great. In terms of 3D printing as an entry into electronics, for sure. There's a couple of resources that are really great for getting started in that. So Tinkercad, for example, is an online browser-based CAD, computer-aided design program. So you just make a free account and you can like drag and drop stuff and sort of meld it together, put big holes in it in different shapes and stuff. Wow, you were on it. Easily create simple things that are, you know, whatever you're inspired by. You can even design circuits to go along with them. And also Thingiverse and GrabCAD, Thingiverse especially, is a good place to get models to start out with. So you can find something online for any interest, like whether it's robotics or just little cute things or like phone charms or ornaments or whatever, or flower pots or lampshades, all this stuff. You can find things to 3D print and or laser cut that will help give you sort of the practice with printing or laser cutting. And then you can move on to modifying those things by dragging them into Tinkercad or building your own things as well. You know, those are both Tinkercad and Thingiverse, great ways to get started with 3D printing if you have a 3D printer at your library.
I've always wondered about, like, if you have to bring your own, you know, filament or how that works. Because that can get expensive.
Yeah, I'm not sure. It depends on the library. But yeah. Maybe they have, like, a part of their budget or maybe it's donation-based. For example, at Noisebridge, you can use the 3D printers for free. But if you use, like, a certain amount of filament, which is, it's sort of the honor system, you know, mm-hmm. you would want to bring your own or donate extra for the filament. One of the things that you might have seen on the Noisebridge donate page is that you can donate to specific projects, and that includes things like the laser cutter or 3D printer or whatever.
Mm. So, let's see. Oh gosh, I'm just, I was so interested. Let's talk a little bit more about Archimedes, because I had a lot of questions. So you brought up the wings. How are you improving the wings?
Oh yeah. So the first time that I designed them, and I think this is still the model that's up online, there are two printed loops that hold the wings onto this armature wire sort of frame that I built. And so that was kind of great because you can sort of pose the wings, and that looks really cute when they're kind of like sticking out and he's like, hey, what's kind of, you know, he has kind of a personality. But unfortunately, when I travel with him, I have to stick him in a box. I got the box here, and I like try to put stuff around him to make it easier. And there's like stuff like foam tape and extra armature wire and things like that for fixing him. But sorry. We'll just pretend that didn't happen. So yeah, when I travel with him, he does tend to, like, the more rigid parts tend to get broken. So his beak will get broken a lot because it's made of these two little pieces of a CD that, yeah, you can just like cut up CDs and use them for stuff, but you have to boil them first.
Why do you have to boil them?
Because the way that they are to start with, they're too thick to cut, and they'll kind of like start separating, delaminating as you cut them. But if you boil them, then they split in half to start with, and then you can easily cut them without that happening. So that would break off a lot. And then the wings would also break off sometimes because those loops just aren't sturdy enough, partly because of the way that they're printed. You know, with 3D printing, you kind of go up in layers, right? So one layer, one layer, one layer. And based on how you print it, if you want a loop or a ring to be really strong, you want that to be in the horizontal plane so that the whole loop is sort of like connected, right? And it's very strong in the side-to-side sort of shear plane. Unfortunately, the way that these wings are printed, it's like from the bottom up. And so when I had these loops coming down, they were sort of like layer by layer. And that makes them rather brittle and fragile. So those broke off. And now I'm trying to replace that with little rubber bands, basically, that hold them to the armature wire, which makes them much more elastic, obviously. It does make them more floppy. So I'm a little sad about the posing right now. But I hold them on with little, right now I'm attaching right angle headers into the wings by heating them up with a lighter, actually, and trying to just shove them into the filament because it melts at a fairly low temperature. So I'm able to, just sort of shove the metal hooks into there. Sounds so metal. and then connect those around the armature wire with elastic bands. And that's a little bit more flexible, but it's still, I think I would like more tension on there because they're a little floppy. But, you know, we'll get there.
And I read that you sort of changed something so it would make it easier for people like at Maker Faire and stuff to take pictures of him.
So So I don't have that hooked up right now because I wanted him to be able to just do the sort of standard motion thing that he does with the Arduino control. What's your problem? Anyway, Diva. So there's a system called Chirp that basically makes it so that you can have machines communicate with each other via R2-D2 noises that encode data in sound. It's really cool. I could do a little example if you want. But, yeah, so we made a Raspberry Pi setup that has a little sound card on it and can listen for these chirps. So I made it so that when I send him emojis from my phone, so like owl happy or owl sad or owl cheese, then he'll like do a specific little animation that I programmed in Python. The cheese one is the specific one for doing photos because like obviously if he's moving around a bunch or like looking off in that direction or whatever, or like over there, you know, then it's not very good for photos. Plus he's like constantly moving around and I have to like unplug him and like manually pose him, which is a little bit stressful because, you know, every time you stress those motors, it kind of is bad for him. So if I can make him sort of do that on his own when I send him a little cheese emoji, then that'll be much easier. And I've got some of those animations programmed, but again, that's not hooked up right now because he's doing his little sort of default little random animation. But yeah, I'm really excited about that. And ideally, he's going to be able to chirp back at me. I don't think you can do it slowly enough that people can actually understand and like reproduce it with their mouths. But what I could do is make like a little wrist-mounted wearable device with a screen where he could say something back to me and I could like tell what it was from like my wrist or whatever. That'd be really cool.
So if someone wanted to, how advanced would someone have to be to go on Hackster, look at your tutorial on making Archimedes and make it?
So ideally, they would not have to be that advanced. They'd have to know how to use a 3D printer or be able to go to 3D Hubs. 3D Hubs is a website that basically connects you with local people who own 3D printers, and they do it professionally so that you can get something really fast and local and fairly cheap, as opposed to Shapeways, which is like a more professional option. So those are both options that you could use to get someone to 3D print the stuff for you. And that's probably one of the most challenging things. You want to have a little bit of experience with crafting just because the way that the harness is made is... it uses this armature wire stuff that sculptors use often to sort of create the base and then also to create this harness. So there's another loop of armature wire that goes around my arm here and then a bit more that goes around this harness, because if you try and just mount something on your shoulder, it's going to fall over pretty easily. So you need more of this sort of broad base of support. And yeah, so that could be a little bit challenging, but I'm trying to make that easier for people. There's a really in-depth version that I sort of prettied up for Make Magazine in the last issue. So if you want, you can check that out, and it has a more sort of beginner-friendly version. And I'm going to be updating the online tutorial to kind of reflect that.
So you also mentioned that you were going to make a more kid version. What would you change to make it more easier for kids? Because my experience is that kids are much more willing to like jump into this kind of stuff, and like they're not like me where I'm just like I'm scared. But what would you change?
Yeah, so there's a couple of interfaces that are pretty easy, or microcontrollers that are easy for kids to use. For example, the Microbit or the Circuit Playground Express from Adafruit. And both of those, I think, would be a good... They can both drive servo motors like this. And I think it would have a smaller set of motors, so like little micro servos that are plastic. And they're much lighter and also cheaper. So those would both make it sort of easier for kids to build with. Both the Circuit Playground Express and the Microbit have this way of programming that you can do that basically allows you to drag and drop things instead of writing out code, although you can also write code for both of them. You have this drag and drop programming interface available that basically enables you to do things visually instead of textually, which could be a much easier way for people to get started with that.
Tell us about the TVB gun. TVB gone. TVB gone gun? TVB.
Yeah. So, wow. Yeah, that one. So Mitch Altman is one of the founders of NoiseBridge and also all around cool guy. Visited Ann Arbor's hackerspace when I was just getting started out there. And so huge inspiration for me. He makes his living selling, kits and speaking at places. And he also voluntarily runs, learn to solder workshops all over the place, like all over the world, literally. Super cool. He created this kit called the TVB Gone, which basically stems from his annoyance at being in public and being assaulted by TVs everywhere. So it's a universal off button remote for TVs. And I got my hands on one of these and I was like, what can we do to make this like kind of cooler maybe? And so I had this old Nintendo Zapper controller from back in the day. And people have gotten mad at me for hacking these, but you can get them for $10 on eBay. So how rare can they be? Anyway, so I decided to mod the TV Be Gone into this form factor of the Nintendo Zapper. So, replace the button with the trigger. I kind of show you how to do that, like modify the trigger in there in one of the videos. I show how to take the whole gun apart, like what kind of the stuff does that's inside. It's really fascinating how that thing worked originally, and then also how to replace the existing circuitry with the LEDs that go down the barrel, the LEDs that are transmitting infrared signals to the TV, for example, because that's how remotes work. you fire an infrared LED at the TV. That just happens to be in a gun now, and it only turns things off, so you go pew! So the TV Be Gone was designed to be really unobtrusive and kind of surreptitious so that you don't get caught doing it. There's one that looks like a cell phone as well. But so this is kind of the opposite of that, obviously. It's extremely obvious what you're doing, but maybe you get to feel like kind of a badass. And it's a better use for a gun than lots of other things, right?
True. Very true.
But yeah.
There's so many amazing projects. Like I said, like I just scrolled through them. What's a good place to start if someone's just listening to this and they think, okay, I'm going to go to Hackster IO? Like, where would they start after making an account?
Sure. So it obviously depends on their level of experience. If you're just getting started out, you would want to go to the Hardware 101 channel, which is a bunch of tutorials that I threw together that have, I tried to make it as short as possible and also sort of really basic. So if you're watching the videos that I do and you're like, I have no idea what this is, then that's totally cool because it means that you're exploring. But also, if you want to know what I'm talking about, if you go through the whole Hardware 101 series, which is like, what's an LED? How do you use it? You know, what are the different basic microcontrollers? What's an Arduino versus a Raspberry Pi? Things like that. Where you might have heard these words before and you kind of have a vague idea of what they do, but you're not totally sure. That's a great way to sort of get the basics down. And then you'll be able to have a sort of starting point for the rest of the tutorials. And then you would probably go into something like looking at what your interests are or scrolling through the featured projects, for example, for some inspiration.
So tell us some of your other projects that you've, I have a list of all of them, but like the Brave, well, not all of them, but I have a list of the ones that caught my eye, the Brave Brainwave Wings or the 3D, how to 3D print Lego. Talk about some of your other favorite projects.
Sure, yeah. So the Brainwave Wings were one of my favorites. Back in 2013, I was invited to participate in Haute Couture, which is this, H-O-T Couture, which is an event that the local venue, the Crucible, puts on. They do a bunch of cool classes like glass blowing and whatever. And so I was like, oh, I want to make some EEG-controlled wearables for this fashion show. So I made a pair of horns and also these wings. And they're based on the NeuroSky brainwave reader EEG device. And more specifically, there's this product called the Nekomimi. And that's Japanese for cat ears, basically. And that's exactly what it is. It's brainwave-controlled cat ears. So I was like, okay, I could do a physical mod on this. I didn't at that point know how to modify them electronically. So I just got the ears and took apart the headband to remove the motors that controlled the cat ears, and sort of extended those wires down my back. Exactly. Using this sort of cable wrapping technique that comes from friendship bracelets, actually. So I love how all that stuff blends together. But yeah, so now the motors were on my back. I made this harness to sort of hold these wings that I made out of aluminum tape and feather strips. Definitely not the best construction in the world, but I thought they looked really cool. One of the weirdest things about that was that the wings were stuck in calibration mode almost the entire time that I was building this. So there you see some like different iterations of the hardware of the harness. So they were doing this really, like, you know, sort of photogenic, sort of little flapping and then a little twitching animation. And then, of course, on the night of the show, they started working, which meant that, like, you know, one of the wings just, like, flopped over to the other side and sort of stayed there, which I'm assuming was because she was, like, really focused on doing the walk and stuff. They had me do a test walk for one of the run-throughs, and they were like, strike a pose, and I was like, that's my model pose. But these people were totally professionals, and I could tell that they were like focused. And so when she did that, it just like that, and it was not very not the best looking effect, but it was still fun. So and the other one worked great because that was just a couple of sort of ram style horns that were made of wire and would like do cool rotatey things. While the model, who was like really good with a whip, was like cracking these bull whips and stuff. It was really cool. I loved that event. One that you probably haven't heard of, maybe, I don't know, is the glow board. This is actually, I did not make the glow board. I was just sort of press ganged into being on it. So this has actually got me and Archimedes on the back. And obviously, since it's called the glow board, I feel like it needs to have some LEDs. So I'm working on augmenting it with LED strips and got into a conversation with Twitter with people about this recently. But on there is a BBC micro bit, which can control NeoPixels, which is what these are. They're Adafruit NeoPixels. They run on 5 volts. They can be programmed to do different animations and stuff. And I'm trying to do something kind of artful with this, the way this wire goes up here. But we'll see. I think I definitely need to make sure that this is very solidly connected and not let anyone like grind on any rails while they're writing it, because that would just instantly decimate the hardware. That would be pretty bad. But yeah, still working on this one, but it'll be out sometime soon. The battery mounting is going to be the biggest challenge, I think, partly just because I don't want to obscure the design.
So a lot of your projects do involve EEGs, like the wings. What's your fascination with those, with EEGs?
Oh, man. So, electroencephalograms, EEGs. I just think it's magic, you know? I'm really into sort of, what I love about wearable tech is that it lets you sense, like augment your senses and control the world around you. Both of those things, like you can give yourself senses that you never had, and you can learn how to like interface with the world in new ways. And also building stuff with brainwave technology allows you to have insight into how your own mind is working. And as with anything else, the first step to modifying the world is measuring it, right? Is being able to see what it's doing now. And then you can sort of work on that. So we made this thinker blinker as well. My friend Mohib and I, because we were just, there we are. It runs on a particle photon right now. So it's like you can control stuff over Wi-Fi. I have a Muse headset, which is a more commercial EEG device. And I slurped the signal out of that using my computer and used that to send JavaScript script to send messages to this particle photon, which like turns on the light if I'm really focusing or whatever. And I think it has the ability to be the basis for some really magical and beautiful effects. So my next iteration of that, I want to be one of those little magnetically levitating planters, you know, with a little plant in it, and it kind of like slowly rotates. And if you could control that with your mind, I think it would be a really nice sort of biofeedback system for learning how to meditate better or whatever. Because I kind of have to bribe myself to meditate with gadgets. I don't know about you, but like that's basically how I motivate myself to do stuff. If I have awesome lights on my bike, then I'm going to like bike around a lot more just because it feels so awesome. And I think that's part of what wearable tech does for me. It makes me feel magical.
I agree. I'm only wearing two sensors right now. So the Apple Watch sensor, and then I have a commercial sensor called Spire. Have you heard of that?
Oh yeah. Spire,
yeah. So you can like push them. You can put them in the wash and stuff. They attach to your undergarments, and they just track you.
I have a Misfit Shine on.
You what?
I have a Misfit Shine that I wear. But I wear it in this little pouch, like sort of fanny pack, but stylish thing.
Yeah.
Because like otherwise they like to fly away, you know, in the middle of you doing something active.
Mm-hmm. So what about security in your projects? You know, a lot of this stuff is connected to the internet. Like how do you deal with that? Like someone, you know, getting all your information. Like whenever I talk about how I love to track myself on various things, someone inevitably says like, well, you know, that information could get out there.
Yeah, so being mindful about it in the first place, obviously. So in this case, Archimedes does not connect to the internet, and that's very intentional. So, I mean, for one thing, people can't hack him, but also because it's made by Google, and I don't want people to think that I'm, like, you know, grabbing their faces and shooting it up to Google's servers somewhere. Mm-hmm. So when I went to DEF CON, I put an eye patch on him just to make that really obvious. But then it turned out that people didn't really care because he's cute. So they were like, yeah, let me see if he thinks I'm happy or whatever. So whatever.
Now you know how to get people's faces if you need it. If you became, you know, some sort of government operative, that's how you could scan everyone's faces.
So, yeah, that's part of the reason why I created him was to create this conversation around it. And I kind of used him as a jumping off point to talk about graceful technology in China and sort of mindfully developing this tech. Like if you're building stuff that does, you know, track people or whatever, you need to be really mindful of security. And I think that IoT is finally like waking up to this. Like for one thing, like smart cars, people finally, like there were a few really bad security incidents with that sort of woke people up to the fact that IoT security is needed. Plus the Mirai botnet incident with like all the, you know, internet connected whatever's sort of being used to hack other people or provide or to do run DDoS attacks on websites, you know, because anything that's connected to the internet can be used to maliciously access something else. Regarding personal security, for one, I try to just limit how much I have extraneous things connected to the internet. But also, social engineering is the most powerful form of hacking. It's like basically the only form of hacking that is 100% effective over time. And so my personal biggest threat model, I probably shouldn't say this online, but like the fact that I put my face and voice on the internet basically every day means that it would be trivially easy to construct a deepfakes version, like AI neural net version of me, and have it do whatever freaky stuff someone wanted it to do in order to like tarnish my name or get me arrested or something like that. That's honestly the one thing that I think is really my biggest vulnerability. And so it doesn't really have to do with things being internet connected as much as just the fact of living in the world and trying to be a person who talks about stuff and shares information and things. Like that very act is one that sort of compromises me. And it's a trade-off that I make every day.
I'm glad that you do, because you explain this stuff so well, and that is a hard thing in this world. I mean, I just feel like being in this world, it's often where there's a lot of people like, well, you know, you can't do that, or, you know, it's done this way or that way. And so the way you explain stuff, I've watched a ton of your videos. It's amazing. It is. I know it's a trade-off. I respect that you make that trade-off, because it's. I think it's worth it to spreading this, especially to young women and I just, I'm glad you're doing it. Alex Glow, thank you.
You do.
Alex,
I think there's a bunch more of your things.
Thanks. Alex Glow is the lead hardware nerd at Hackster.io. Watch her video. She does. I'm so impressed that you do a lot of like live Facebook stuff. She is a great interviewer, and check out all her projects. There's so much stuff that I haven't mentioned. Your Girl Scout, you have a Girl Scout cable management video that I watched.
Yes.
Great. You can follow Alex on Twitter. It's @AskGlowAskie, ASCII. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much. This was so much fun. Have a great week.
Thanks. You too. And thank you for joining us. We record Triangulation every week, usually on Fridays, but sometimes other days. And you can watch live if you find us at twit.tv/live. And you can, of course, download it on any podcast tool that you have. We're available everywhere and on YouTube. Download the show and subscribe. And I am Megan Maroney, and we'll see you next week on Triangulation.